It began as a routine mission.
There appears to be a massive displacement wave moving toward us.
And it would change their destiny.
Captain, there's something out there.
Brace for impact.
One crew and one ship's epic journey 70,000 light years away.
We're on the other side of the galaxy.
Now, it's a quest to get back home.
Why are you holding us here?
See it from the beginning.
We have no way back unless you send us.
On the premiere of Star Trek Voyager.
Transfer complete.
Hello and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge,
this is Tyler Orton, turning into a bird and flying away.
And we have a very special guest arriving from a rural alien setting, Vicky Sue.
Hi, everyone.
I appreciate you bringing your banjo with us in that corn on the cob.
Oh, yes, yes, I know. You guys always appreciate any musical entertainment that I bring.
Of course.
Well, Vicky, it's been, is this your first time in 2017 that you've joined us on the show?
It is my first time in 2017.
Well, we appreciate, we get so much fan mail all about you requesting you that you come back, so we're finally glad we can make that happen for listeners.
Oh, great. I'm glad I've got some fans out there.
Okay. Cam, what is our conundrum this week?
We're going to go back to the year 1995.
Wow.
When Voyager launched onto UPN and changed the world. We're here with Caretaker, the spectacular premiere episode that left people shocked, awed, and ready for more.
Well, Cam, let's start with you. Your first reaction when you saw Caretaker, just about a few years ago.
Yeah, I guess it was about, 3 years ago?
Yeah.
I believe that I started watching it because I had just finished TNG, and I think I made a point of barreling through season one of Voyager right before the 2014 August Con, Star Trek Con in Las Vegas. Because what I wanted to do was have a little bit of Voyager under my belt because I'd finished TNG. I wanted to be able to see panels with Kate Mulgrew and what have you, and for once know what they were talking about.
Yeah.
So I just wanted a bit of knowledge. So I watched Caretaker. And at the time, I didn't dislike it at all. I think because I had very low opinions of Encounter at Farpoint as well as Emissary.
Right.
My opinion on Emissary changed, as if you can go back and listen to our Emissary episode with Mike Hager from a little while back. But at the time, I did not think Emissary was a good pilot at all. And so I walked out of Caretaker thinking, like, yeah, that was pretty good. I felt like I got a good sense of the characters. It set up the premise of the show, and I didn't really have any complaints.
Vicky, was your first time watching Caretaker, in fact, about 22 years ago?
Well, now that you put it that way, I think it probably was right after Moesha was on or something.
Yeah. Do you remember that episode of Moesha where she asked for a car for her birthday and they got her a Saturn and she wanted something else and she was really upset about it?
I really don't remember. And
nope.
I try not to remember Moesha, but I do remember the opening, like the song for it.
I can perform it right now if you'd like.
Oh, I would like that very much.
That'll be for only our patrons, unfortunately.
That's a copyright issue.
Yeah.
Well, is that a paid feature that you're doing for the fans?
Yep. All that fan money coming right in to hear me sing the Moesha theme song. But that's UPN for you. Yeah, I remember watching Moesha and Pigsty. That was another one on UPN. The Sentinel. 7 days. There are a couple other UPN shows.
I didn't watch any of these shows.
Not even Voyager at the time.
No. Yeah. I remember I was in art class in grade 8, and I was sat at a table with three other guys who were all big TNG fans, and they were all really excited for Voyager. I remember talking to them the day after it premiered.
Yeah.
And I think they enjoyed it well enough.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I mean, obviously, Vicky, you're probably in preschool if this premiered 22 years ago. So, what was your reaction as a child watching Star Trek Voyager for the very first time, the series premiere?
I don't remember what my reaction was, but it was probably when we watched it was us at home, and my uncle was a big Star Trek fan. So
is he the one who got you into Star Trek in your household?
Yeah, we would share the TV. So if he was watching Star Trek, then I would be watching Star Trek.
Okay. And then, I don't know, did that, okay. You don't remember your initial reaction, but do you remember watching Voyager consistently enough afterwards?
Yep.
It didn't throw you off. It was something that you wanted to continue with.
Yep. Yeah, I enjoyed Star Trek, and I guess that's why I'm here today.
I would hope that's why.
Okay. Did the series stand out to you from other Star Treks at the time?
Well, I wasn't a DS9 fan, so I definitely had tastes for Star Trek, because DS9 was on TV as well, and I didn't really care for it.
Right. Right.
You know, I was kind of feeling the same thing. My own personal story, though, is I wanted to watch the series premiere of Star Trek Voyager more than anything. I had the TV guide that was talking all about it. It was a special edition TV guide. It went into Star Trek Generations as well.
Right.
And so there's so many interviews with cast members. They had like this dossier of the crew. I kind of knew everything going in. Anticipation rising, and my parents, instead of letting me watch the first hour of Caretaker, they forced me to go to this church youth group, and I begged and I pleaded, guys, please just let me watch it.
Pray the Chakotay away.
Yes. So my sister got to watch the entire series premiere. I only got to watch the last half of it, and then I figured, well, okay, you know, when you're like 10 years old, you know, I mean, that's like waiting until the summer to watch the rerun, that seems like a lifetime away, but I figured I could do it.
You can get your sister to record it on the VCR for
Believe me, we have tried figuring out the VCR at our place, and we just couldn't figure it out at the time. It was 1995.
The technology was just too advanced at the time.
I felt like Neelix beaming into an Intrepid-class starship and just trying to figure things out. It was over my head.
I see.
Yeah. Do you remember those days where you'd be rushing home with your parents? Like, and there was going to be a show starting, and you were watching the clock in the car.
Yes.
It was terrifying.
I would get so anxious. Yes. And be like, Mom, Dad, come on.
And
we're going to miss
timing
step
out
by
in
step.
Your head.
Yes.
Like, you'd be going like, oh, my God.
How long does it take to get home?
And yeah. The opening credits are going to get me to like 8:01 or whatever. Yeah.
It's like, okay, maybe I'll miss the teaser, you know, but yeah. Okay. Stress-inducing.
Kids can't relate nowadays.
No. Oh, DVR and everything.
Yeah.
Whatever, streaming on YouTube. Could you imagine if that was your childhood, Cam?
No, I can't.
No, okay. So guess what? The summer comes, and they never reran Caretaker.
Really?
So I had to wait until the series was syndicated until I saw the series premiere in its entirety of Star Trek Voyager.
You didn't get your sister to reenact it.
I did. And I asked her, what's going on? What's up with Harry? Why is he not aboard this ship? I was reading his dossier, but he's not on the ship right now. What's going on? Where's Harry Kim? A lot of Harry Kim questions. Yeah.
And they continue to this day.
Yes. But my sister filled me in as much as she could. But honestly, I probably have not seen the full series premiere in about 17 years.
Now, I have a question. Later down the road, you started writing Voyager fan fiction.
Yeah.
Now, did Missing Caretaker impact now, you know, your feelings as to how that those great literary works were being spun?
That's okay. You asked that question being very derisive towards me and my fan fiction, Cam.
Only semi.
But in fact, that is a good question, because yeah. I did not actually realize at the time that I was writing the fan fiction that one Joe Carey actually appearing in the premiere.
Right.
So, I mean, just now is a big reminder that Joe Carey, who was featured in my fan fiction, that's why it's a significant thing, that, you know, so maybe it would have changed things just a little bit.
Right. Interesting.
Yeah. Is it?
Well, it kind of is, because, you know, in those days, you didn't have those episodes on demand.
Sure.
And so, you know, I'm sure many fans who did write fan fiction, if they'd missed episodes of even like original or something, they may have been confused as to what they're writing.
So, Vicky, I was very much like you. I was not a fan of Deep Space Nine at the time. Now it's my favorite Star Trek series. But at the time, I just really, Next Generation had ended. I wanted to get on to a ship again and just watch like these interstellar journeys. I was so excited about Star Trek Voyager. And after watching the premiere at the time as a kid, I was like, oh, man, they've taken the mantle successfully from Next Generation. I was so excited about the future of the franchise from here on out. So, Cam, flash forward, you know, a couple years later, it's no longer, you know, the summer of 2014. What your reaction, your initial reaction just watching this series premiere once again?
It's okay.
Okay.
I feel like it has a lot of problems, and a lot of them are Voyager problems, actually, that continue through the series.
But is it mostly, you're looking through the prism of time, and you know what the problems are?
Yeah, I think so. It's like, I know what to kind of look for. Like, when going back and revisiting Emissary, it became much clearer to me how that show kind of was really the starting point for the pilot was really the starting point for everything that the show would pay off over time. Watching Caretaker, I mean, I asked you after, I'm like, did they even pay any of this stuff off? I guess they did in season three.
Yeah, you had asked specifically about the female Caretaker.
Yeah, like I just did not remember that, but it didn't. I just felt like the overall story as to how they got to the Delta Quadrant was so uninteresting. What really actually grabbed me far more in this pilot was all the just character introductions. Those I enjoyed far more, and I thought they set up, again, their characters really well. But, I mean, I have a hard time getting behind a pilot, you know, hour and a half spectacular opening that, like, climaxes on a rickety bridge.
Yeah, I did find it a little boring.
In the second half, especially. Yeah.
Okay. You know, the pacing, yes, I agree, there was a pacing issue in the second half. And why don't we get a little deeper into the character introductions in a little bit. I want to know your reaction, you know, 22 years later. Have you seen the series premiere since you initially watched it as a kid?
I don't think so. I mean, I may have seen either part one or part two, but I have not seen it in its entirety.
So you probably, how much of this did you remember, Vicky?
I remembered the gist of it. I remember that, you know, the caretaker sent them into the Delta Quadrant and they had no way of coming back. And, you know, as I was watching it, I was jogging my memory and I realized, oh yes, Harry Kim and Balan Torres got sent to the Ocampa and that the caretaker was ultimately responsible for them, or he felt responsible for them at least.
My most vivid memory was when Neelix blasted the water containers open. Yeah. So, I mean, like this almost felt like I was watching it for the first time in many ways. But look, just now, I think so far out of the series premieres that we've watched at this point, this is in the upper tier of setting up the universe, introducing.
Does that say much?
It all has to be on kind of like a curve. I have to grade it on a curve right now. You know, just based on. Look, I don't think Trek has a great track record when it comes to pilots.
Right.
We're going to have a very interesting discussion when Discovery premieres, and I think we're at the point. Whoa, there are fireworks going off right now in the city of Vancouver. I can see them through my window. Cam, can you see them?
I can. They, too, are celebrating Caretaker.
Wow. I'm sorry to get distracted, people, but they're like, I can see downtown from my apartment, and they're blasting for no reason. I don't know if people realize this, but the new Trump Tower opens in Vancouver officially tomorrow. I wonder if they're celebrating the fact that Eric and Donald Jr. have arrived in town.
No comment.
Okay. Just putting it out there on February 27th.
Sure.
2017, it could be a Trump celebration.
All right.
Sorry, guys.
We obviously weren't invited to the party.
No. Yeah. These are beautiful fireworks. Vicky, you cannot see them, but...
I cannot, unfortunately. Right. Well,
it's like to catch a thief over here.
Okay. Well, okay. I don't remember what I was talking about, but it was something about Star Trek Voyager and my reaction now. I think this is one of the stronger series premieres, and we can go dive deeper into it. But I think you bring up a very good point about character introductions. I like the idea of the universe building that they have here. I see a lot of potential for this series.
Yes.
Coming out of this, and look, Cam, we're going to be having this discussion for a while about whether or not Star Trek Voyager lived up to its potential.
Right.
But I don't blame anybody for being really excited after seeing this series premiere, seeing what Star Trek, the next iteration of Star Trek, could be all about.
Yeah, and I think what this show had to do is set up Captain Janeway as a captain we could really get behind, because she's coming after, you know, Picard, Sisko, Kirk. It's important to establish that your captain is really cool right out of the gate. And, you know, she has a really great reveal where Tom Paris hears her voice and, like, gazes up in wonder as the mighty Janeway looks down upon him.
Yeah.
Great, you know, quote unquote. I think that her dialogue was very awkward.
Mr. Paris, I'm here to bring you on a mission.
It was very awkward a lot of the time.
Okay. Well, I don't know. To me, she came off as so distinct from all the other captains. I think that's the key here, is you don't want a captain who just seems kind of like a carbon copy of whoever preceded that individual.
Yes. And but, I like that they set up her mission statement for the series, where she's saying, you know, she's never gotten time to know her crew. It really is setting up what her arc is right off the bat, which they did not do with other captains. Like, what was Picard's arc if you look only at Encounter at Farpoint?
get off the bridge.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
I guess that it was going to warm up to Wesley, I guess. Yeah.
Well, did you notice when they were in her ready room and she was talking about Ensign Harry Kim, and she was talking about him as if he'd already died?
Yeah. Yeah.
And the viewers are like, eh.
Yeah.
Yeah. She's like, well, I never really got a chance to know him. Like, did you know that he played, in past tense, the clarinet?
Yeah.
Yeah. Is his mom not a bit of a helicopter mom where she's contacting the captain of a starship?
It's an Asian thing.
Is it? Okay. For the record, Vicky, you are of East Asian descent, so we don't get angry letters from our listeners. Yeah. So I guess you can comment on that there.
I wouldn't say East is East Asian.
Yeah.
Really?
Well, no. I'm guessing you're
not East Asian.
Your family's from Hong Kong, right?
Yeah, but that's not East Asia.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
It is. Yeah.
All right. I'm not offended.
Now I feel like I'm like being like the white guy telling people what their culture is.
Well, this is uncomfortable.
Yeah. So Harry Kim, guys.
Yeah. Yes.
His mom, a total helicopter mom. There.
Yes, but that's sort of established a bit that his mom is a little, you know, overbearing towards him.
We see that in Favorite Son. Right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. As well as, I believe, the episode where he's in a different timeline.
Oh, Non Sequitur?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. We see a bit of it there.
Well, okay. I think, let's get into it with the character introductions. We're introduced to Captain Janeway. Mm-hmm. Vicky, you're a little on the fence about her. Maybe the dialogue isn't the best. I think that there's some great stuff like, oh, Mark, you bother me, except for the ways that I like to be bothered. You know, like those kinds of lines there.
Could they have found a less dynamic actor to play Mark?
Oh, okay, let's talk about the triumvirate of generic 40-year-old males that they, white males that they hired here. Because you've got the doctor.
Yep,
the original doctor.
Yeah, the doctor and the commanding officer.
Yep. You wrote down his name, didn't you, Vicky?
Yeah, it's Lieutenant Commander Cavett.
That's the only time somebody will ever recite that name on this show.
That's true.
Yeah.
Well, we don't even know the doctor's name.
No, he's just
doctor.
Yeah. And then we're not talking about like the Robert Picardo character.
No.
Yeah. And so there's the doctor, the first officer, and Mark, and they all look like the same exact dude. Did they all go to the same audition and they're just trying out randomly for the same role and they're like,
you're good. Yeah, all right.
It's like they were background extras that got promoted up.
Yeah.
It's interesting. Originally, one of their plans was to put the names of those two, the crew members, the doctor and the first officer, in the credits so fans would not know that something was going to happen to them.
Ah. I would have liked that.
Sure.
Yeah. They wanted to do that for the series premiere of Buffy the Vampire Slayer as well.
Like, oh, really?
Yeah. One of... guys, the show premiered 20 years ago, so spoiler warning, but there's a character in there, Jesse, who was friends with Xander, and he dies about halfway through, and they wanted him in the opening credits just so you thought that he was part of the Scooby Gang. Mm-hmm. Anyways, I digress once again, and there's not even fireworks in front of me this time. But so character introductions. What about the introduction of one Tom Paris here at the penal colony? Because I think if there's one character this episode's about, I'm not so sure it's Janeway's story. I really think that this premiere is the Tom Paris redemption arc here.
Yeah, that and the Chakotay come over to the light side, you know.
Do you think this is a Chakotay story in any way,
though? I don't
think
it's a Chakotay story, but obviously that ties into it. Okay. To where he is at the beginning versus where he is at the end.
Right.
Vicky, what do you think about Tom's introduction here?
Well, I think it's good because they leave a little bit of a cliffhanger. You still don't really know what incident that Tom Paris was involved in. You know, what led to his betrayal of the Maquis or his dismissal from the Federation.
Sounds like a kind of a crappy Starfleet officer and an even crappier Maquis mercenary as
yes,
well.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Well, you know, he can't have been that bad because they're springing him out of white-collar prison at the start.
Yeah, what is he doing?
What is he doing?
He's got like a laser pen. And he has to point the laser pen at panels.
Is that like hard labor in the future?
It must be.
Well, he's
sign me
the
up.
Sun. He's up in the sun. You
know? He's in New Zealand. You know, that's not a bad penal colony to be in.
No, it'd be my one of choice.
Yeah.
I mean, Tom Paris is really funny to me because I like the character. I like this is very un-Star Trek.
Yeah.
Because normally it's kind of a cast of perfect, you know, beings and doing their jobs flawlessly. Whereas here's a guy who's kind of a screw up.
And he implies that he has an alcohol problem.
Yeah.
Which never is touched upon.
He's cynical again. In a way. Like, he's cynical against Starfleet and towards like authority.
Yeah.
Which I like a lot. It's just funny to me, all these sort of like bad boy shades are played off of Robert Duncan McNeil.
Yeah.
And it's sort of this weird combo where I like Robert Duncan McNeil and I like Tom Paris, but as one entity, they are problematic because he in no way looks at all edgy or weathered or, you know, like a guy who's seen and done things.
He needs to have a scar on his face.
Or an eye patch.
Okay, well then you know what? I think we need to get into the real Tom Paris / Bobby McNeil backstory here, because this was originally meant to be Nick Locarno, as featured in the Star Trek Next Generation episode First Duty, played by the same actor here. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Nick Locarno, he was the guy who's an ace pilot who convinced everyone to cover up the death of one of the other cadets at the academy. He ends up, Wes makes it very clear with a lot of pressure from Picard that he's going to turn everyone in. And then Nick Locarno takes the fall eventually, even though Nick Locarno is a bit of a creep, you know, to a certain degree. Kim, do you I buy McNeil as Nick Locarno, but you don't seem to quite buy him as pretty much the same kind of archetypical character here as Tom Paris. What do you think? Is there a little bit of cognitive dissonance here, or what?
I think it's the
fact
that they really kind of set up Tom Paris as kind of a badass.
Sure.
You know, and we see the other Maquis. We see Chakotay, B'Elanna Torres, Tuvok undercover, and as well as extras as Maquis. And they
Ayala,
look...
did you recognize Ayala?
No.
He's one of the few extras that appears in, like, every single season.
Okay.
One of the Maquis members. Anyways,
but they look rough and tumble. They look like guys who could fight their way out of a situation.
Is it the brown clothing that gives it away?
Vests.
It is. It's
the
best. Yeah. No, but they look like kind of a tough crowd to deal with, versus Tom Paris does not. He looks like Blake. Wasn't it
Pretty in Pink?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
The James Spader kind of character?
Yeah.
Okay.
And so, like, I just have a hard time buying him in that sort of tough guy kind of spot. He seems more like a guy who would be in white collar prison for some sort of financial crime.
Was he meant to be the tough guy or the bad boy? Because I think there's a bit of a difference between a bad boy and a tough guy.
It's true, but when you introduce a character in a penal colony...
He's probably meant to be the bad boy if he's an admiral's son.
Yeah.
Yes.
Cam and I, we actually had a big, long discussion about the bad boys of Star Trek. Episode number... We'll maybe link to it on the blog or something.
Sure.
But worth a discussion. The bad boys of Star Trek. Find it at subspacepod.com. But Vicky, who do you think the bad boy is aboard Star Trek Voyager? Would Tom be the archetypical bad boy of the crew?
Well, they certainly paint him out to be, but if you were to ask me to name one person, I would say Chakotay.
Really?
Yeah.
Mm.
So personality doesn't matter when it comes to bad boys, then?
It's a combination of things.
Like, do you think he's got the right look?
No, he doesn't have the right look.
He doesn't have the raw animal magnetism that Robert Beltran has.
Yeah, needs to have, you know, he needs to have like the 5 o'clock shadow on his face or something.
Like the Han Solo quality.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. He's no Han Solo.
He is not. He's a Luke.
So, okay, but I think the reason why we're talking so much about Paris, I mean, obviously, I think The Caretaker is a Tom Paris episode, which is kind of strange, you know, because Tom Paris, I think, had so much potential to be an even more prominent character on the series, and he's one of the more mid-tier characters, not one of the ones that was forgotten about, like, say, Tuvok, but also he's not part of the Janeway Doctor 7 of 9 triumvirate either.
Right.
So, Tom Paris, lots going on there. I'm sure we can dive even deeper in later on, but what do you think about the introduction at the very beginning of the show? We get Tuvok, Chakotay, and B'Elanna Torres right there in a battle with the Cardassian Gul Evek, another recurring Cardassian character on the series. How do you think this opening sequence compares to the Battle of Wolf 359 that we saw in Emissary, Cam?
Well, that one had far more emotional stakes than this one does.
The death of Sisko's wife.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, this is just sort of a quick attention-grabbing kind of action sequence.
But how does this compare as an action sequence, regardless?
I think that one was... The one in DS9's Emissary paid off better because it didn't have 1995 CG too heavily.
Yeah.
I honestly think if you're depicting Battle of Wolf 359, it's going to be tough to top that.
Yeah.
And I really think that this is kind of a losing, you know, game on the part of the writers if they want to open up with an action sequence.
I don't think it really matters. I don't think
this is supposed to grab you as a series premiere. This is the teaser. I think I do think it matters.
But
quite
Wolf
a bit.
359 means a lot more to Trek fans than whatever this little escapade is.
All right, that's what I'm saying, though. Yeah, how are you able to top that?
They don't relate in scale. This is just like a quick jolt sort of moment.
No, but exactly, they don't relate in scale. Like I think that this is like a bit of a failure of an opening sequence because right. Cam, you already spelled it out though. It was far more emotionally involving yes. in Emissary, and I think it's a much cooler sequence as well. Vicky, what do you think?
Well, I don't think that they're trying to focus on the conflict between the Cardassians and the Maquis, and that's where your issue is, because why are they having this big battle sequence if that's not where the focus of the episode is?
I was actually more kind of disappointed that like I'm not really connecting to the characters that much, and this sequence kind of pales in comparison to the opening sequence of Deep Space Nine, just in terms of kind of the grandeur and the scale. Like, it just seemed like, hey, it's kind of a typical, like, little Star Trek skirmish. And this is supposed to be your introduction to the entire series. And right. I'm just like, I don't know if this is enough to be a gripping
intro. I have to disagree
intro.
With you. The introduction to the series was that opening scroll.
Okay, yes. The Star Wars ripoff opening scroll. Yeah. There.
Right.
Yeah. All right. Okay, so Vicky, what do you think about the introduction, though? Let's just talk about B'Elanna here. She's showing off her engineering skills. Mm-hmm. Tuvok, he gets in a few words, and Chakotay. we don't see them again for another hour, but I mean, what do you think about those three being introduced here?
There's really not a lot to go on as an opening sequence.
That's why I also think it's kind of a failure of an opening sequence, because we don't see these characters for another hour.
That's true, but I do think Chakotay leaves an impression, largely due to the tattoo. It's just a distinct... I mean, he is the first of the crew members of Voyager to be on screen in this series. We get to see a big close-up of him. He sticks in our mind, at least as a visual. And I actually think Chakotay is probably... He's actually done fairly well in the first... chunk of this to of Caretaker, and then he just follows the crew around for the second half or something silently. But in the first half, like, I felt a little bit of menace to him, that's sort of swagger that disappears completely. I mean, it's obvious that Janeway has a real taste in bland first officers, and just sure. you know, one died, so you got to replace with a similar model.
Well, let's say Chakotay was not replaced. The next in line for first officer would have been Tuvok. So you're right, bland first officers, Cam.
Right. Yeah.
Guys, the next character introduced, Harry Kim. We see him mingling on the promenade in Quark's bar. He's getting hustled a little bit, and Tom Paris can't help but take notice of this. What do you think of the introduction of Harry Kim, Vicky?
I think they kind of set him up for failure.
What are you talking about?
Hey, he's a young kid, fresh out of school.
How young is he?
I think he's meant to be like 21, 22.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, I think it's kind of funny that right away Tom Paris kind of takes him under his wing.
Yeah.
That's a little odd there.
That's what I did with Cam our first day at school. I saw him getting like picked on and hustled.
Ben Young was trying to sell me gemstones.
Yeah. And Cam's like, ooh.
So How much?
Yeah. I took him under his wing. It all worked out in the end. Yeah. Cam, what do you think of Ensign Harry Kim here?
I think Harry Kim's fine. He doesn't, you know, he has a little spark of naivety that I think is fun. But I mean, I think Quark is the one, you know, Armin Shimmerman is the one stealing that whole scene.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm far more engaged watching Quark wheel and deal than I am watching Harry Kim, you know, just kind of fumble.
But, you know, that's what his role, he's supposed to be like the young kid who doesn't know who hasn't seen the universe yet.
Right.
You know, how do you think he compares with, say, a Wesley, probably the next youngest character? Other than, I should say, Kes, right?
Well, he's not smartass.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's true. I mean, I think he's fine. I think he's earnest. He's very much the audience avatar in this episode. We're seeing sort of this crew through him a lot of the time.
I would call Tom Paris the audience avatar.
But we don't relate to Tom. We relate to Harry Kim, who's kind of the wide-eyed innocent going into this.
But the fact that Tom is such a flawed character, he seems the most human out of all the characters here.
I think it's more the Luke Skywalker thing. Like, we're seeing, you know, like, Tom Paris is supposed to be kind of the Han Solo.
Right?
We are Harry Kim, the Luke, who's kind of wide-eyed, like, wow, we're friends with the cool guy. Mm-hmm. And you see, like, Harry Kim walks onto the bridge of Voyager, and it's just like this wide-eyed look around the bridge, like, can you believe where I am?
Yeah. Okay, fan casting. Vicky, who then would be the Princess Leia among the Voyager crew?
I would say it'd have to be Kes.
Kes.
Mm-hmm.
The Leia.
I know that, that she...
That ball of charisma there.
She comes out, like, in her opening, she comes out as, like, a scared puppy dog or just a helpless girl, but for some reason, when she gets into sick bay, she suddenly has this courage and she chimes in. She's like, "Oh no, wait, Neelix! But we have to help these people."
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. We should nickname her Kessie Fisher at this point.
Okay.
Cam, who'd be the Chewbacca?
Tuvok.
Okay.
Yeah.
They get about the same amount of dialogue.
Yeah, they're kind of the heavies.
Okay.
And they're both fairly quiet.
Okay,
but I want to say about the Armin Shimmerman cameo. You know, we've seen that, especially into the Berman era, primarily, they had this real tradition of send-offs. You know, having like a character from a previous series kind of send off this new crew in style. Where do we rank Armin Shimmerman's Quark versus McCoy in Encounter at Farpoint and
Zefram Cochrane in Broken Bow from Star Trek Enterprise,
as well as obviously Jean-Luc Picard in Emissary?
Yes, I think Picard takes the cake among all those. Honestly, did the McCoy cameo do that much for you, Cam?
No.
Yeah.
No, it didn't. Like, I would say the Quark is a second place. The only reason I put the Picard one highest is because it actually ties into the overall story, whereas the Quark one is just a fun little distraction.
Yeah. I don't know. Vicky, did you like Quark's appearance here?
I did like Quark's appearance, but, you know, maybe his appearance was just showing the naivete of Harry Kim.
Oh, yeah. I definitely think that was the goal here. It just would not have been the same if, I don't know, he went to that Klingon guy who sells gah in the promenade.
Right.
Or what if he went to Garak?
That would have been a whole other
I would have been situation. Intrigued by Harry Kim trying to, I don't know, wheel and deal with the likes of Garak.
Tom Paris would not have been able to intimidate Garak. That's why they went with Armin Shimmerman's character.
Okay, so we're introduced to Harry Kim. We know he's like the kid fresh out of school. And then I think the next character that we're introed to is the Doctor, the holographic Doctor.
Yeah, kind of an afterthought in the episode. We get a basic idea of his function and that he's, you know, kind of persnickety. But
he's played for laughs for the most part.
Yeah, you would not watch this episode and be like, well, there's going to be one of the great enduring characters of this series.
Exactly. Because he becomes pretty much like the breakout character. I would say, yeah, 7 of 9 is. But yeah. He's a very close second there.
Right. No, I agree.
I don't know, Vicky, what did you think of the introduction of the Doctor here? Were you intrigued? Do you remember being intrigued by the Doctor when you're younger? Or did you come around with him, I don't know, as the series progressed? What were your thoughts?
I probably came around to him as the series progressed because, you know, he's just a prop.
I think that's a good way of describing him.
Yeah, yeah, he gets a couple of, like, comic beats. But that's about it.
Yeah, you do wonder, okay, what are they actually going to do with this thing?
Right.
Like, is this actually sustainable for a character?
Yeah, I don't think that you realize that he is actually going to become this full-fledged character.
Yeah. Okay. So after that, then, that leaves us with Neelix.
Neelix, I thought, was really interesting.
He was meant to be the kind of breakout character, you know, their version of Quark, right?
And he's played very alien and unusual, which I really liked. And it kind of is like, how did they wind up with like the simpering man baby that the series turns him into shortly thereafter, where it's just like he's just like happy, seems like he's on, you know, uppers at all times,
yeah,
kind of character. Versus here, he's weird. He's kind of
kooky.
Yeah, he's kooky. He's interacting with strangers, you know, in a bizarre way. It's kind of like
drinking a lot of water.
It's kind of like Yoda's first appearance in Empire Strikes Back, you know, where Luke's like just looking at him like, what is this thing?
Yeah,
like, you know, they have Tuvok playing off Neelix early on, and I like that. Like, I like seeing Neelix, who's, you know, the scrap salvager. He's like a guy who can kind of survive everything. By the end of Voyager, I'm like, Neelix couldn't survive anything.
Let's get into very briefly one of the overall themes of this episode, which is kind of this idea of dependency. The Ocampa became very dependent on the caretaker, and I guess the destruction of the array, it's going to ignite a new era where the Ocampa are going to have to learn not to be so dependent. Do you think Neelix missed out on that theme and he became just overly dependent on Voyager and its crew?
It seems like it.
I'm trying to justify like his character arc somehow, because he does seem like he has a lot more potential to be far more interesting than what we get by the time we hit season 7 and he's hanging out in that asteroid belt with the rest of those Talaxian colonists.
Isn't that what happens, though? I mean, you just get comfortable and you get complacent.
That's why this, you know, that's what this podcast is like at this point after this many episodes.
Cam and I, we pretty much just phone it in every
week. We're looking at fireworks out the windows. Just, you
know. I get easily distracted.
Droning on and on.
They were beautiful fireworks, though.
No, yeah. I just think it's interesting. In season one, Voyager, you know, I've talked about the episode Jatrell before, how much I like that episode. It really seems like early on they had more interesting things in mind for Neelix. And this episode gives hints of that. That's sort of, he's a little bit opportunistic. You know, he's willing to kind of use the Voyager crew to free Kes.
I thought it was really funny that he seemed to be enjoying his bath and, you know, drinking gallons and gallons of water. And meanwhile, his beloved is taken prisoner by...
it didn't seem all that urgent to him go and save her from a life of servitude.
No, that's true.
You know, she had clearly been beat up in there. Yeah. And he was fine.
Well, the Kazon character of the Kazon Ogla said that he'd used every method he knew of to try to convince her to tell him how to get into the subterranean Okumpa layer.
Right.
Oh, I don't know what to make of that.
No.
Yeah. Okay. Well, easy segue then. What do you make of Kes? You mentioned that she's the Carrie Fisher / Kessie Fisher of the crew. What do you make of her introduction here with her black eye?
I think her introduction is good. It was, it was a really... stark contrast between, you know, when you first met her down on the planet and when she speaks in sickbay on Voyager. But I guess a question that I wonder about the Okampa in general is that they seem quite intelligent for a race that only lives 9 years.
Right.
I always try to justify these things in my head, and my argument is like, well, they're aliens.
And does that make Neelix a pedophile?
That's been brought up on this podcast before, but I
as well as jokes that may have been edited out of the podcast.
Yeah, not our jokes. Nope. A particular guest made a joke.
You know who you are.
Yes, he knows who he is. But it is a weird thing that I don't think the writers really spent that much time thinking about. They just were like, oh, they're both aliens. For all you know, Neelix is one.
Yeah,
I don't know.
I don't know. The Kes as a character is one who I actually quite like. I think there's a lot of interesting Kes episodes to come. I don't think this pilot, at least in my opinion, set her up as a character that was that interesting.
No, I'm kind of surprised. Like, they include her in this pilot. Did the writers have a lot of great plans after?
No, they didn't. Because there's that scene at the end. I commented on it as we watched it, where Neelix is like, "I'm going to be your guide. I can do anything. I can cook. I can dance. I can, you know, et cetera, et cetera."
Yeah.
And then Kes is like, "Yes."
And they're like, "Let me join you."
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
And it's like, and then I joked. I said, "What do you offer, Kes?"
and then when she goes back to her colony, it doesn't seem that anybody has really missed her all that much. She's like, "Oh, like she left for like."
There's a lot of Okampa to keep track of. You know?
I guess so. I guess
no, but
so.
It seemed like she was gone for like a weekend.
Yep, exactly.
But maybe that's why Neelix wasn't so urgent about like rescuing her.
But is like a 2-year-old Okampa kind of like an 18-year-old teenager? Where you're just like, "Ah, I give up."
Yeah, I think that has to be the case there.
She's like, "I want to live my own life."
Yeah. So overall, guys, what we're getting at here, though, we've tackled all the characters, though, and I just realized, okay, if we're calling her Kessie Fisher, then we should have been calling him Tuvaka.
Oh,
just came
hashtag Tuvaka.
But look, what I'm getting at here with regards to all these character intros is kind of this idea of world building, which is something I think if a series does it well, boy, I'm invested. And I think it took a while, but Deep Space Nine did a very, very exceptional job on this. And I think for a pilot episode, I think Voyager did a good job of this kind of world building with the introduction of the characters, the introduction of the premise, which I think is a great high concept sort of premise.
It is.
Mm-hmm. And I think, Cam, let's pretend we don't have a crystal ball. We don't know how it all ends. But, I mean, how do you think world building fares in a pilot episode such as Star Trek Voyager's Caretaker?
I think it works well because it establishes a very simple premise. You know, two crews from two different worlds working together to get home. Brilliant. Like a lot of the other premises for the series, like the premise for DS9, when you just lay it out on paper as a pilot, it's kind of like, well, it's
and then
it's
the
not,
station doesn't go anywhere.
Yeah, it's not ultra compelling just to read that log line. Mm-hmm. Whereas I think the premise of Voyager may be the most ingenious premise of any of the Trek series. I mean, what is the premise of, like, you know, Next Generation? It's like, well, they're going to explore.
Yeah.
You know, but they can go home, then they'll leave, then they'll come home. You know, like there's no kind of There's no urgency to it. Whereas with Voyager, there's genuine urgency. We want to see these people get home.
Well, there's a mission.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And so I really like that. And I love the idea of two crews being forced together. Now, that will not pay off in any way, shape, or form. You know, we see Chakotay is all surly at the start of this. And like two episodes from now, he's like yelling at crew members for kissing in the turbo lift. But I mean, it's a great idea as a, you know, as a pilot.
Vicky, I don't know. What do you think about just kind of the overall setup of the premise here? Do you think it was successful getting people excited?
Yes, I think so. I mean, and I'm going to agree with Cam here. There is a certain sense of urgency, and there is obviously a problem that they're going to be aiming to solve.
Yeah. Okay, guys, I'm still going to go a little granular here, just because I'm.
Is it because of that sand planet?
not granular like that, Cam. Anyway, no, I just breaking it down because it's still in kind of this universe building though. But like as a child, I was so excited looking at just the new sets, like the new engineering, the new bridge, the sick bay, you know, that sort of stuff made me excited. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Do you remember your reactions at all just seeing how this looked like a 90s version of Star Trek versus I think the Next Generation was very much the set design that was very 80s
yes.
Star Trek there.
Yeah.
What was your reaction to like those little things that I'm talking about? Just kind of the set design, the ready room. Like, did it like make you, I don't know, find that it's an even more compelling universe just because it seems like such an updated version of Star Trek versus what we saw just 7 years earlier?
Well, Janeway's ready room definitely is a lot more spacious.
Oh, yeah.
Than Captain Picard's ready room. And you know, I was thinking when Tuvok was telling Janeway that she needed to get some rest, like, you know, you definitely have room for a bed in there.
I actually thought the same thing. It's like, yeah, she could just nap in there, nobody's gonna like call her out on it. And she's got a bathroom in there too. It's like, it's all good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I know.
It's okay. Well, what about, you know, maybe just the look of engineering or look of the bridge, like, does that do anything for you, like making you excited thinking about the kind of the They're paying a lot of attention to how this universe is going to be different than what we saw in Deep Space Nine.
Well, definitely. Like, yeah. Deep Space Nine is a lot darker. You know, it's kind of a show of shadows, right? You know, there's all these elements kind of at play just off screen with DS9. This is much more of that optimistic. It's shiny. There's a lot of silver and gray, light gray.
There seems to be a lot more luxury as well.
I mean, yeah.
With the guest quarters that Neelix was in. Right. There was a full-on like jacuzzi in there.
Oh, yeah.
Right. Yeah, like, Voyager seems friendly. Like, it makes sense. It's their home, right? So they make it more homey than any environment in any other Star Treks, really.
Well, it was more homey than the Enterprise was, which is surprising.
No, I mean, the original Enterprise is kind of very, like, almost like military vessel. Mm. And then the Next Gen one is kind of like a hotel lobby.
Yeah.
You know, it's sort of professional.
But okay.
Comfortable, but professional.
Yeah, I agree with that. It kind of reminds me of like a Holiday Inn.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So but the one advantage that I think when we compare Encounter at Farpoint to, say, Caretaker, though, is I have a much better sense of what the bridge looks like or the feel of the bridge. Same with engineering, even though we didn't see much of engineering in Encounter at Farpoint. But here, we only got, I think, like two very short glimpses of engineering, even though like it looks cool, you can tell that it's a multi-story sort of set. I think we spent more time in sickbay, or at least I got a better sense of what sickbay looked like than any of the other sets that we were introduced to here.
To be fair, Voyager had far more interest in sickbay than it really did in the engineering section throughout the series.
I will not disagree with that, yeah. And I think that's indicative of the B'Elanna versus Doctor characters.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. Of course. So yeah, look, I thought the sets looked like a cool update. I wonder, though, I kind of appreciate, if you look at the Enterprise-D, it's not as utilitarian as, say, Voyager. I kind of appreciate that it's almost like the D is an iPhone and the Voyager is an Android, almost. And I mean that like an Android phone.
Not Data.
not Data. Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
No, I sure. I mean, yeah.
That's a resounding, you know, like support for my statement there. Thanks, Cam.
You're welcome.
Sure. If you say so.
All right, guys. Cam, I don't know. What do you think of just other silly things like, I don't know, transporter effects?
Transporter effects do not jump out at me, like, in sort of the, aside from original series, which obviously looks different. Once you get to the TNG, Voyager, DS9 transporting effects, I don't really... They've never jumped out at me as like, wow, look at the difference between each series.
It's, well, you know, the... transporter effects that the caretaker used were quite interesting.
That is true. Yes.
The blinding flash of light.
Very godlike.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess that's one way of putting it.
Yeah.
All right. Well, transporter effects aside, maybe why don't we jump into kind of the story itself?
Yes.
Because I wonder if that's one of the weaker aspects of this episode that maybe you're alluding to, Cameron.
For me, it is, because the initial idea of just like, hey, we got to assemble a team to track down Chakotay and his men. Like, that works.
I mean, do that every Las Vegas Star Trek convention.
There you go.
Yeah.
Maybe I missed this, but why did they need to track them down? Is it just because Tuvok was on the ship?
No, yeah. I agree with you. That is a little vague. I think they should have done a better job maybe establishing who Chakotay is and why they need to get him.
That's why they had the Star Wars crawl across the screen.
Yeah, that's quite true. Yeah. But, it doesn't feel like... It should feel like Janeway feels driven to complete this mission in a way that she doesn't by other missions. You know, this doesn't play like it's just any other mission if you're springing someone out of a prison to help you.
Yeah.
And it was funny because she didn't play the long game, because once she beamed Chakotay onto the ship, she was just like, oh, and by the way, this was my undercover officer.
Yeah.
Like, she could have kept Tuvok undercover for even longer.
Yeah, she
just wanted a break from Tuvok, maybe.
Yeah. I mean, She may have integrated the two crews, but does she really know, who's on whose side at that point?
Yeah, he could have given her the lowdown. Because remember, there's that episode Worst Case Scenario where we find out that Tuvok created that holographic program as kind of a test run in case the Maquis ever tried to take over the ship. Tuvok clearly had question marks about their loyalties. I think it would have made a lot more sense for him to stay undercover even longer, and maybe he would have been roped into any sort of insurrection.
That would have led to drama in the series, Tyler.
And conflict.
And conflict, which we never got. Yeah. It does not pay off later. But I like the idea of that sort of initial, jumping off point for the pilot. We got to get this guy. We got to track him down. I wish they'd done a better job building up Chakotay's personality. Mm-hmm. But then we would find out later Chakotay didn't have a personality. So perhaps this is accurate to what would come.
Yeah.
But I like the idea of that. To me, where it gets a little iffy is once we get to the whole caretaker aspect. And they're going down to the rural planet. And little did I realize
playing
at this
banjos.
Point, yeah, little did I realize at this point, that it would pave the way for Fairhaven, as well as that episode where we saw the Q Continuum and it was also a rural setting.
Yes.
It's just fine.
It's a simple life, Cam.
I'm sure they went to William Shatner's horse farm and shot that over a weekend.
I actually thought of Star Trek Generations when I was watching that scene.
Yeah.
What has less appeal to you? Going to that farm or going to the Captain Kirk cottage?
I can escape this one a little better than the cottage, probably. The Nexus is a little tougher to get out of.
Oh, yeah.
Although it doesn't seem like it's that tough, but either way.
Yeah, I think you just have to will yourself out of it.
I think so.
Yeah. Okay.
And it does have Guinan on a merry-go-round, so it does have that going for it.
Yeah, but, give me the Nexus any day.
To me, that is not a very compelling... Star Trek's all about exploring the unknown. And when I'm seeing a rural setting and people playing the banjo, I'm not like, wow, what is this mysterious and amazing future? Tell me more.
Yeah.
And once... I just never felt invested in the caretaker story.
But we mentioned it earlier, but I think that's when the story really slows down because we're getting a lot of these action-packed sequences. We're getting a lot of character introductions for that first hour.
Yeah.
And it's bam, bam, bam. I actually think that the sequence in which the crew is trying to recover from their journey to the Delta Quadrant, where you have to be in the medical bay, Janeway, she's rolling up her sleeves, going down to engineering, telling them what to do. The bridge crews, half of them dead at this point. Very exciting stuff. And then they all get sucked into the caretaker array, and we watch them play banjos. I'm just okay. And then we are introduced to Neelix, and he drinks a lot of water and takes a bath. And then we go down and see the Kazon really like water.
Yeah.
And then we see that the Ocumpa, they live in a underground mall.
Or a convention center of some sort.
Yeah.
It looks like an airport to me, actually.
You thought airport? Yeah. I thought maybe convention center, but yeah. Mm-hmm.
I was thinking food court.
Food court,
yeah.
Is that why Neelix can cook so well?
Yeah.
Well, and where is all the light coming from if they're 2 kilometers underground?
Yeah, don't ask these questions.
It's the future.
Vicky. Yeah, okay.
It's a bright and bold new world.
I see.
But let's talk about that, though, because the story's about, hey, the these advanced beings create this cataclysmic environmental disaster on this planet, and they feel that it's their obligation to repay this debt and care for these aliens. I think that's an interesting premise, mm-hmm. you know, and I think, you know, the overall message, and it's good that we have a character like Kes that brings it forward, that we need to have some independence. We can't be, you know, just we can't treat everybody like I'm Harry Kim's mother and I need to get that clarinet back to my boy.
Okay, well, but if the people who, like, the elders of the Ocampo, like, why haven't the ancient tunnels been sealed and why are they so well maintained? Or are those more questions that I'm not supposed to be asking?
I've got no answers for you. You just keep making me sound dumber and dumber.
And they're obviously trying to parallel the caretaker's sort of smothering hold over the Ocampa with Janeway's sort of matriarch relationship with her crew.
Yeah.
I just don't think the connection is built up very well. Like, I would have liked maybe something that really resonated with me when it was over, as opposed to just like, whatever. Like, the caretaker to me is just not interesting. And I know this episode, this whole pilot and a lot of the premise was inspired by Q-Who. And TNG episodes were like Q would just make things happen to the ship.
Right.
And that was kind of their jumping off point for that kind of storyline. But Q is far more compelling as a written character. And obviously John DeLancey is great.
Than a banjo player?
Yeah. Well, the thing is, they never give the caretaker a spark of personality that I was really drawn into. And
he's
so,
like he's just kind of the old crazy guy.
Well, he's like a B-level Boothby.
That stings.
Wow.
But yeah, I mean, so I just never was drawn into that story, and so because I didn't care about the caretaker, it didn't resonate the way it needed to, that Janeway isn't going to be like him. She's not going to order this crew around. She's going to kind of let them grow and nurture on their own with, you know, her guidance. I think they really could have underscored that a lot stronger. Like, you know, you look at Emissary with the way that it sets up Sisko letting go of his, you know, wife's death and being able to move past that. Mm-hmm. There's genuine emotional, like, growth at the end of that episode. I didn't feel like the lesson it wanted to show that Janeway was learning was communicated very well.
Okay. What about interpersonal conflict throughout this episode? Who do you think that there's the most conflict between Vicky?
Paris and Chakotay.
Yeah, that's kind of what I
picked. I completely disagree.
Really?
I think it's the dead doctor and Tom Paris.
There you go.
That's true.
No, I agree.
Yeah, it's Paris and Chakotay, even though, like, they don't really have that much of a history together. They went on one mission.
Yeah.
Paris effed it up.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess it's establishing, firming up that connection between Paris and Harry, because Harry's just like, I don't know, it's my first mission too. And like, they both kind of had crappy first missions.
Mm-hmm.
So, but...
Well, I mean, they did get to have that great bonding moment where he saved him from the rickety stairwell.
Yeah.
Where he gave like racial jokes to the audience.
Yeah, I briefly talk about that. I think we all had a collective reaction of shock when we heard Tom Paris ask Chakotay if he knows the little Indian trick where he can turn into a bird and fly away. I mean, this is like Star Trek. Like, this is supposed to be kind of like the post-racial, all-encompassing kind of like acceptance of different cultures. And Tom Paris is making jokes about like someone's Aboriginal heritage.
I feel like it's a sad statement that, like, at this point in time, you couldn't say such things about most people from around the world, but it was fair game to say it about, you know, Aboriginals.
Yeah.
And that's a problem just with society in general.
I don't think, look, you're going to be able to get away with that in Star Trek Discovery.
Not a chance.
Yeah.
Not a chance. Yeah, I mean, it's played goofy and light, which was very common for, especially entertainment.
For racist jokes?
Yeah, for sure. That era and before. You know, it was very common in American entertainment. Okay. This may have been the last stand for that sort of thing. Because
1995?
Well, I don't know about necessarily that year, but shortly after it would be phased out. Like, you wouldn't see that as much.
But, I mean, how common was it that any character in Star Trek would remark on another human character's race? I can't really recall it. You know, we have Far Beyond the Stars, but that's not... Did Sisko ever, you know, did people ever say, hey, Sisko, you're black? Like, that would never happen, you know?
No.
And so it stands out to me as just bizarre
Star Trek. And no one's saying to Harry Kim, you know, like, where are you from exactly?
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't matter. It is strange.
Well, it's because it would spark a debate about East Asia versus like sure. you know, other parts of Asia. So it was going to get uncomfortable. So yeah,
yeah, it is weird. It, you know when they wrote that line, you know, those lines regarding Chakotay into the script, they're like, this is going to be a little bit of a comedic beat during this action sequence. I don't really think they were thinking ramifications through.
Yeah, I'm just surprised that that's not a line that I ever recalled, and you don't hear fans complaining about that line nowadays.
Do you think it's people are willing to be more forgiving of it because it comes from Tom Paris, who's established as a bit of a, snarky guy off the bat?
I think people are more willing to be forgiving of it because that they don't care. Like they just they honestly just don't care.
Yeah.
I don't know. We live in Vancouver, which has a very significant Aboriginal population, more so than like the average American city.
Right.
So I think maybe it's something that we're more cognizant of. But
right.
I don't know. It really irked me. But even though I guess I made a joke of it at the very beginning of this podcast.
Way to be sensitive, Tyler.
I don't know. I'm actually 1/16th Aboriginal. So
oh,
I don't
really. And it irked you.
Yeah.
Oh.
Well, not as somebody who's 1/16th Aboriginal, but like just as like an observer of humanity.
Sure.
So,
observer of humanity. Give me a break.
What? How dare you, Cam? Now you're being culturally insensitive to me. Yeah, much like Tom Paris is an observer,
right,
aboard Voyager.
Sure.
Yeah. Okay. Well, one little silly thing, because that's all I do. I like to go for the granular here. But do you notice that it's very early on that I think it's only once or twice that they refer to the ship as the Voyager.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, they're just calling it Voyager, mm-hmm. and it's mostly because they're like Janeway to Voyager. You know, because it'd sound awkward if she was saying Janeway to the Voyager.
Right.
You know. So and because whereas
I don't know, I don't think it does.
But you know, they always refer to it as the Enterprise. Never as Enterprise, except until you get to Star Trek Enterprise, and all of a sudden Archer's just calling Enterprise.
Right.
Do you think they take the off, though, because Voyager becomes a home? And you don't say, I'm going to the house or the home.
No,
Voyager is home, Tyler.
I think you're giving them way too much credit. I honestly think it rolls off the tongue better.
How do you think this pilot would have worked had... Originally, they wanted Brandon Braga to write it, but he was on vacation.
They wanted him to write it?
Yes. And he was on vacation.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
That's not something I've ever heard before.
Really? Well, that's something that they write on Memory Alpha, that he was, they were very interested in having him do it, but he wasn't available.
Oh, yeah, you know what? I put that entry in there as a joke to fool you.
This is part of your fan fiction.
Yeah. Oh, no, I'm curious. I mean, I if I was Brandon Braga and I knew I'd be getting residuals for creating a series for life, I would have gotten out of that vacation and written that series pilot myself.
It's just funny to me because when I look at Voyager as a whole, I think of it very much as a Brandon Braga show.
I agree,
because
yeah.
of so much of what he brought to it. And it's just odd off the bat that obviously he has nothing to do with it initially.
I mean, he's there episode two.
Sure.
Yeah.
But as a pilot, you know, it's Michael Piller, it's Jerry Taylor, Rick Berman, mostly written by Piller, but with notes from Taylor and Berman. But I don't know. Like, to me, this doesn't feel like Michael Piller firing all cylinders, creating a new world.
It's no Star Trek Insurrection.
No. No, it is not. There's a little less HMS Pinafore. Like, do you think, out of the gate, did they seem inspired by what they were setting up?
Catching lightning in a bottle is a very tough thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, would you say that they seemed inspired based on what you saw in Encounter and Farpoint?
Definitely.
No. Apples.
No.
Stop it with the apples.
Yeah, no.
Yeah.
No.
I don't know. What do you think? I mean, was this an inspiring pilot to you, Vicky?
Well, I think that... a lot of the emotions were missing from the episode.
Like
when, you know, I think if you're stuck in that position and you realize that you're 75 years from home, I think that she didn't seem to give it any second thought.
Do you think she just really actually wanted to break up with Mark?
Do you blame her?
And this was like the easiest.
It's like, oh, way. I don't have to take care of the dog anymore.
Yeah. I wonder if that, because she was giving him a lot of instructions for taking care of the dog.
It's true.
Yeah. Okay. But guys, let's get into this, though, just before we wrap up, though. What do you think about Janeway's decision to violate the Prime Directive? Destroy the array to prevent the Kazon Ogla from, annihilating the Okampa and leaving her crew and the Maquis crew stranded on the other side of the galaxy?
I thought about it, and when she said that, you know, they were already involved, it's true, because if the Maki ship wasn't there, then it wouldn't have shot out that Kazon ship, which wouldn't have broken the arm on the array, which wouldn't have ended the self-destruct sequence.
Zing. Yeah, I mean, to me, this establishes that Janeway, while a follower of the Prime Directive, is going to be in a situation where there's moments where she can't follow it because desperation is going to take hold.
But
what separates, to me, Voyager initially from, you know, Next Generation.
Do you think Picard would have gone back to the others, to the Alpha Quadrant?
Do I think he would have gone back to the Alpha
Quadrant? Do you think he would have sacrificed, you know, kind of that journey?
That's an excellent question.
Because it's not as if Picard has a lot of these, like, he doesn't have a dog at home or a fiance at home or anything.
I think he would be willing to take the, you know, 75-year trip back home if need be, yeah.
I don't. Okay, let me ask you more on a philosophical level, guys. What if you were a member of the crew and your captain decides, hey, I'm going to... I'm sorry, guys, but you're probably going to die before we make it home. Like, we're going to go on a long, long journey home. What would your reaction be to that, Vicky?
I would be pretty pissed off.
Yeah?
Yeah.
You can understand V'Lana reacting the way that she did.
Yep, totally.
But do you understand Chakotay?
Especially since she's just a fresh member of the crew.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, she's not even a member of the crew at that point. She's still in her vest.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I wouldn't be thrilled. But I know in that situation that I have no say whatsoever.
Yeah, what if your commanding officer is Chakotay and you demand to know who Janeway is to make that decision and Chakotay tells
drags
you...
drags you back by the... collar?
She's the captain, that's who.
I'd just be like, oh, damn it. Yeah. This was the wrong ship to take a journey on.
I don't know. To me, it's like, I would be livid. I'd be like, yeah. I mean, I understand that... Here's the thing. If I was a captain, I'm not so sure I would sacrifice this group of people for the Ocampa.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I don't know.
But
it's a tough question.
As a captain, you also have a duty to adhere to the Prime Directive.
And she violated it, though.
That's true.
That's what I'm getting at. Here's the thing. If, let's say, hypothetically, I'm the captain of a starship, I would not be willing to violate the Prime Directive in this situation. I think there's a lot to lose, but maybe Janeway just really wanted to explore this side of the galaxy. I don't know.
Maybe you're right. She did want to get away from Mark just that badly.
I think my initial reaction was correct, in fact. Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm glad that we settled that.
Obviously, the show, she has to make that decision for the good of the show.
Yes, obviously.
And so I think...
But does it reflect on her as a leader?
That's the thing. As a leader... I don't know that I know her well enough as a character if this is the first episode to make that judgment call.
Yeah.
I think as we see the series go, I think it makes sense. I don't feel offended. Like, I don't go back in time and watch that episode and be like, boy, they didn't know how to write Janeway at the start. You know, this feels consistent with the Janeway character throughout the series.
Yeah, I agree with that, yeah.
And so I can forgive it.
It seems like something she would do.
Yes, yeah. That's true.
I did think it was a bit of a bummer, though. You know, you were talking about the lack of emotional resonance at the end. You know, they're 75 years from home. They may never get home. And Janeway gives this big speech to the crew walking around. You can tell they want this to be their big powerhouse moment of the episode.
It's not, though. It falls flat.
It's not. Yeah, it does. Like, the dialogue is... I think it's serviceable. I think... And I don't even think Mulgrew's to blame. It's just...
It's
an issue of direction. It's an issue of the episode leading up to it.
Well, you don't really... I mean, aside from B'Elanna, you don't really see any of the crew members grumbling and groaning about the 75-year journey. It's like, okay, well, this is what we're going
to
do.
Well, she does announce that people are going to have to get along with each other, and that creates like this great exchange between this extra and Harry Kim, who just look at each other in the eyes and shrug their shoulders.
Well, that's the problem. I think if the crew had been more at odds with one another, we would have felt like they needed to build something. Mm-hmm. But it's really hurt by the fact that there's like five of Chakotay's people we actually see on the show. It's like a very small number of Maki we actually witness mingling with the Voyager crew. So it doesn't feel like two huge crews being put together. Right. It feels like the Voyager crew and like five people.
Cam, I'm going to name as many of Chakotay's crew as I can.
Okay.
So you've got Chakotay, Seska, B'Elanna, Mike Jonas, Lon Suter and Ayala, who I name dropped earlier today. That's six. Oh, what about the Delaney twins? Did we ever establish if they're Maquis members?
I don't know.
Wouldn't it be isn't it a big coincidence for Starfleet to assign two twin sisters to one ship? I think they must be Maquis members.
You would separate twins, right?
Yeah. Well,
in case something happens to one ship, you don't want both of them going?
Sure.
I don't know. To me, it's like...
Is this like Saving Private Ryan?
Yes. It makes sense to me. Like, if you're out exploring the cosmos, you don't want, you know, both like family members on one ship.
Okay, so let's say the Delaney sisters are Maquis members then.
Okay.
Okay, so that's over the course of seven seasons, that's eight people I can name.
Yeah.
I actually think that's pretty good.
I think they would have been better off really splitting it even more. Like, kill off more members of the crew, you know, than we see than the two. Like, have... Because even the Doctor, you know, obviously the Doctor dies, but he's replaced again by a Federation Doctor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, don't you think this should have felt more like a skeleton crew?
Yes.
You know, like, we should have seen a lot of empty consoles on the bridge a lot of the times.
Yeah.
Empty quarters, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm.
Like, really two ragtag groups having to come together.
Yeah.
And, you know, it doesn't feel like that because Janeway even says, we're going to follow Starfleet rules at the end. It's like, okay, so it's another Starfleet show.
Yeah. Vicky, what do you think of this idea that by the end of the show, they're out of their vests and all the Maquis members, they're wearing Starfleet uniforms? Do you think that's, kind of damaged the potential for this interpersonal conflict that we were promised by having this Maquis and Starfleet crew working together?
No, I don't think so. I mean, as a captain, I think that you'd want some cohesiveness. So stripping the Maquis of their plain clothes, quote unquote.
I call them vests.
Okay. Well, stripping them of their vests, I think it sets a precedence because you're establishing that it's a Starfleet ship.
Oh, you're coming at it from a logical captain, though. I'm coming at it as like a writer of a Star Trek series, because this was a big point of consternation among the writers and the networks, whereas the writers did not want this.
Yeah, like Ron Moore was not, he just rolled his eyes that they were going to just have them all unite at the end.
Was it Ron Moore? Because he was not on staff or anything.
No, just he said as a Star Trek fan, he thought that they really lost the what could have been a great series right off the bat.
Yeah.
By having at the end Chakotay and everything in a uniform, it's like, okay, so what you had was an interesting idea that you've completely gotten rid of by the end of the first episode.
Yeah, and it's like them on episode two finding a wormhole, and they're like, we're back in the Alpha Quadrant now, guys.
Yeah.
It's like, okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What was the point of that? Okay, guys, before we wrap up, Vicky, any final thoughts or observations that you had that you wanted to share? Cam, I'll throw that same question out to you if there's just stuff that you think is worth sharing to our listeners before we call it a night.
I thought it was funny when you see the array kind of being blown up. I thought it looked like a grandfather clock being blown up.
You see, to me, the array looked a lot... Did anyone here at the table or someone listening right now play the Nintendo 64 game Star Wars Shadows of the Empire?
Oh, yeah, I did.
Do you remember Prince Zizor's Skyhook fortress that at the end you have to blow up?
Which level was that?
It's the last one.
I never made it that far.
Okay. Yeah, like Prince Zizor, the villain of Shadows of the Empire, has this huge base called the Skyhook. And to me, the Skyhook, I doubt they modeled the Skyhook on the array. That seems unlikely. But boy, do they look similar to me.
Okay. Cam?
Yeah?
Final thoughts?
I mean, I think that this is a serviceable premiere. I think it is hurt by the fact we know that Voyager wouldn't pay off dramatically in the ways we would hope.
Yeah.
And so I look at this pilot as being emblematic of all of those decisions later down the road, where it does feel a little bit drained to the drama you'd hope for from this premise.
Well, and I guess it's quite reflective of the season, or not the season, the series finale as well, because it's kind of underwhelming as well.
Yeah, it just doesn't... It feels to me like a series that... is good, but oh so rarely great. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the way I feel about this premiere. It's good, but there's not much greatness here.
I totally agree with that there. Okay, a few final thoughts here. One of my favorite quotes. Hot plain tomato soup. This is Tom Paris at the Replicator.
Yeah, real bad boy.
He makes a big deal of it as tomato soup. And I also like the idea that when Harry Kim addresses Janeway as Sir... And then he stumbles and calls her ma'am. She's like, I prefer captain.
I like that.
I like that.
Yeah. You know? No, like, Janeway has good character moments here. They do a good job in establishing what makes her different, say, than Picard or Sisko?
Yeah. Finally, guys, I swear, last question before we wrap up here. What do you think about the design of Voyager, the ship itself? We talked about like the interiors, but do you think this is kind of the new style going forward for Starfleet?
I like the curviness of the ship. It's not like a giant saucer.
Yeah,
I think the saucer was a little awkward.
Like the if you look at the size of the saucer versus the size of the body of the ship, yeah. It is very very kind of warped. Or, no pun intended, but it is a very different sort of not the best.
It looked flimsy.
Scale, yeah,
yes. Flimsy.
Yes, I agree.
I like the Voyager too. I think it it's
no just Voyager.
It's unique looking. It feels different. Like, it must have been tough at this point to design a ship that is similar to the Enterprise in look, yeah. But feels different. Feels like a unique ship that deserves a name other than Enterprise. And I think they pulled it off. I'm just curious, though, when you saw this, you know, pilot way back in the day, did Voyager jump out as like, oh man, this is such an awesome ship?
Yeah.
Did it?
I think so.
I was impressed.
Okay.
The one thing, though, at the time, I did not realize just how small it was compared with the D.
Right.
Because it is pretty... Grow up, Cam. but if you look at my paraphernalia that I have... Sorry. My Star Trek toy paraphernalia. I've got, like, models of the Enterprise D, but I don't have any of Voyager.
Right.
So that's my difference.
Does your girlfriend enjoy those toys too?
Okay. Real mature guy.
I couldn't resist.
Okay. Props to you, Vicky. It's well deserved.
Okay, well, on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Send your thoughts and feedback to subspacetransmissionspod@gmail.com. Let us know what you think of the Voyager premiere. Were you a big fan? Do you think it is, you know, in the upper ranks of Star Trek premieres? Let us know. We'd love to hear it. Tyler, what the heck are we doing next week?
We are taking a deep dive at Q. You and I were going to have a fun one. We have
Q who?
DJ Q.
Oh. You don't say.
Yeah. Hiding Q. Q-less.
Keep
Cupid.
Going. Q in the gray.
Q in the gray. Yeah.
Q2.
Death Wish.
Well, that just really kills the
streak
there.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Okay. I think we're all out of Qs, though.
I think so.
Yeah. Anyway, so we're this is one of the most iconic characters in all of Star Trek. We're going to take a look at his entire history from Next Gen, DS9 to Voyager. John Delancey, what a man. We've got a good guest lined up. He hasn't been on the show since 2017 started. Very excited to have this guy back on. You'll have to tune in to find out who it is.
Yeah, I think that's going to be a really fun episode. I always like these sort of big breakdowns of a character in alien species episodes we do. I think this is going to be a good one.
And who doesn't like Q? Vicky, do you like Q?
I love Q.
There you go.
Yep.
And sorry we didn't invite you for next week's show. I apologize.
Oh, well, I'll make sure to be there in spirit.
Thank you.
And you can find it on iTunes.
Yes.
You can also reach us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam, V is in Vests and Hoedowns Smith.
You can find me at Reportin. That's REPORT. T is in Tuvaka, ON.
Nice. And Vicky, you're not on Twitter, are you?
I am not on Twitter.
What's your home address? If people want to send you snail mail?
I live on the Voyager.
Okay.
Gotcha. Good call. Good call. Okay, well, until next time, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.